It couldn't be better timing to have one of our two weather guys joining us this hour on the Lee Rayburn Show from at 12:01 this afternoon from the National Weather Service in Green Bay. A tornado warning remains in effect until 12:45 for Calumet, southwestern Manitowoc, northeastern Winnebago, and south central Outagamie counties. At 12:01, a confirmed and extremely dangerous tornado was located over Appleton, moving southeast at 40 miles per hour. It includes damaging winds and 3-inch hail. It was confirmed by radar. I hope you are staying safe where you are today. Earlier, I saw tornado warnings briefly for Dodge, Jefferson, and Waukesha counties, followed by Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth. Some unstable weather out there. Perhaps you have taken some pictures. I hope you have done so safely. In fact, I insist that you do. And if you want to share those pictures with our weather guest today, you can email us talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. If you have questions about Wisconsin's weird summer weather and how dangerous it has become, you can also give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And our expert is Steve Ackerman, former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, welcome back.
It's great to be back, Lee, although the weather isn't all that great for us.
Man.
Wisconsin, geez.
I thought spring was more likely for tornadoes, and with the tornado warnings both in southeast Wisconsin and central Wisconsin today in the Appleton area right now, why are we seeing what we're seeing?
First, typically our tornado season is really, in severe weather, is in June and July. Because that's when we get the conditions of moist air near the surface that's warm, and then once that gets lifted, it's easier to get thunderstorms to develop. And if you can get rotation in that due to the location of the jet stream, then you can get tornadoes. Although having said that, this past April was rather a odd year for tornadoes. We typically, Wisconsin on average, gets 23 tornadoes a year. And in April, we had 27 tornadoes. So, yeah, right? It's really, it was just a weird year. And then May came and we got one. so it's just going to be an odd summer, I think, that we're going to have to get used to.
So, yeah, would we expect that this isn't an anomaly going forward, but more extreme weather would be at least part expectation?
Expectation is, in the type of climate change that we're seeing, that we are going to have more thunderstorms, more extreme weather. Whether or not April is due to that or just, one of those years where things lined up and we got a whole bunch, I think we'll have to spend some time trying to figure that out.
Now, I had the opportunity to live in the desert for a few years, and everybody was very proud of their dry heat. It's a dry heat, they would say, in 100-degree temperatures while slowly cooling off in the pool. But I got to say, Steve, this is some wet heat we've been having in Wisconsin. I guess most of my summers growing up in Wisconsin were near Lake Michigan, so I got that nice lake breeze, and I don't remember it being sweaty like this.
And this is different, I think. I mean, we do get humid summers, and I would rather have a dry heat than a high humidity, for sure. But this morning, I was up at 6 in the morning, and I looked at my weather station, and it was 79 degrees, and it was foggy. There was a mist outside. So I knew that today was going to be one of those what I call New Orleans days, where it's just hot and humid. And for me, not very pleasurable.
No, it's a wet heat here today.
It's a wet heat, yes.
So can you explain the humidity for us and why it, I mean, for me, I could take 90 degrees without humidity, but 79 degrees with high humidity is uncomfortable.
It makes it really uncomfortable for me, too. And the reason why is the way our bodies cool down is through perspiring, sweating. And then when we sweat, that evaporation of the sweat causes and helps our body cool down. And so as it gets humid out, it, you know, you have less ability to evaporate that sweat. That's why dry heats, as we were just talking about, don't feel as hot, because, and we don't often get sweaty,
right?
Because it evaporates so quickly, and that's what helps keep our body cool.
Do you have expectations for the rest of this summer, forecast-wise, Steve Ackerman? Could we expect more sweat? Could we expect more severe weather?
I would go with more sweat and more severe weather. Although, you know, May, again, we may go back to an odd year, an odd month like we had in May, where we really didn't have very much.
Right. It's weird to look back and think, and you wrote about this on the Weather Guy's website, that we had a relatively mild spring. It feels like so long ago now.
Yeah. And it depends on, in overall, I think spring turned out to be average. And that's because April was so wet and we had a lot of severe thunderstorms. And then in May, it was just slightly below normal in terms of precipitation. And so things kind of averaged out when we look at spring as March, April, May.
Well, the averages seem weird, Steve, because with some of the severe rains we've had and then the extended stretches without any rain at all, it would seem like the averages could say that we've had an average amount of rain, but it certainly doesn't feel that way, the way it comes down and then the way it stays away for so long. That's just anecdotally, not from any sort of meteorological perspective, just living through it.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of living through it, you know, my gardens are dry.
Yeah.
And when I see thunderstorms beginning to develop and head towards Madison, you know, I get, all right, great, we're going to get some rain. But then it kind of splits. And, you know, some goes north and some goes south. And so we haven't been getting much precipitation at our house, although I think areas around us have gotten some good storms go through.
And I am in Madison, too, and it feels like our precipitation has been hail or nothing.
Right.
And maybe we shouldn't laugh about that, because that is not great for your garden, Steve.
Not great for my garden. And in June, we had some of those strong winds, too, the end of June.
Oh, yeah.
Which also wasn't good for my garden or my roof, as it turns out.
I've seen a lot of signs for roofers out and about and a lot of new roofs getting installed, but I've also seen a lot of old trees that have had to come down as a result.
Yeah, yeah.
So we talked a little bit about an average spring and the extremes we're seeing this summer. Any prognostications for fall? I just want to hear you say a crisp, cool, good old-fashioned Wisconsin fall. Could that be in the cards?
I'll go out on a limb and say it's going to be crisp, a little bit above average, but generally cool. And beautiful colors.
Yeah, well, always, every time.
Right? And that's why we're here, right? Get that change of season where we see all those trees turn beautiful oranges and gold.
But one of the stories I've seen about Wisconsin weather in particular is that with the change, with climate change, one of the results has been warmer Wisconsin nights. And boy, have I felt that the last few nights, that while days may be similar, our nights are warming up.
Yeah, and we saw this in the spring and in June, where a lot of the warmth above normal was seen in the nighttime temperatures. And that's a general trend that we're seeing. We're seeing global warming. Things are warming up. And in particular, it's those nighttime temperatures that are creeping up on us and therefore not getting as cool.
Why is that? What are the mechanisms that are doing that particularly in the nighttime?
Well, if it gets warmer during the daytime or at any time, generally that means there's going to be an ability to have more water vapor in the atmosphere. And once you have more water vapor in the atmosphere, it then retains that heat. And so it doesn't cool down as much in the nighttime. So like we were saying, you know, a dry heat in the deserts,
yeah.
In the evening it gets cold
out there, man.
Because it's dry again. And when you have a lot of humidity in the atmosphere, that difference between maximum temperature and minimum temperature decreases.
So what's with all the humidity then? Where is it coming from and why is it sticking around? Why is this happening in Wisconsin, especially in our summertime?
It's generally associated with the global warming that we're feeling across
really?
The entire Midwest. Yeah. As the temperatures go up, the amount of water in the atmosphere is going to go up.
Oh,
and we're surrounded by lakes, so that also then helps get water vapor in the atmosphere.
Yeah, so the evaporation from hot days with all of our waterways would then make it humid. That humid would then make it harder to cool off at night.
Exactly.
And you start to see this cycle about the weather that we're having and some of the extreme weather that weather conditions that are a result.
Right.
I think I just kind of put that together.
You just summarized it very well.
Steve Ackerman, our guest emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and you are welcome to our conversation about Wisconsin weather today as we are seeing some extremes and in the Appleton area, tornado warning as we speak. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email. If you've got pictures, Steve's got his email open. You can email us your pics or questions at talk@wpr.org. Darren emailed us. Steve, could you explain downbursts and what caused them?
Yeah. So downbursts are generally associated with severe weather, thunderstorms, mesoscale complex systems, which are a series of thunderstorms that are grouped together. And those generally form when you have upward rising air. But if air is rising upward, you know, we just need to have that conservation of mass. Air is therefore coming down someplace.
Mm.
And if it is the right organization in the storm, we can have a very strong downdraft in that convective system that gives us that downburst, a really strong downward motions associated with the thunderstorm or the complex system of thunderstorms.
Are those becoming more common as well?
That's an interesting question. I don't know what the statistics are on that are.
Because a cold front moves into a hot front just by physics, right? Because the air is more spread apart in a hot air and cold air, it's more... No, it's the other way around. Cold air, the air particles
more
are
dense.
More spread apart and the hot's more dense. So it just... nature abhors a vacuum, so it sort of moves into that place where there's space for it.
Yeah, but when we start talking about downbursts, we start talking about the circulation of the air through the storm more than the coldness and the warm, which helps get the storm started. But when we get strong downbursts, a lot of times that's associated with sinking air in the storm, which sometimes gets pulled down also by the precipitation.
Once
the rain falls and the hail falls, it's also going to pull air down with it.
You had talked about the jet stream earlier as part of what makes these extreme conditions that'll create these tornado warnings like we're seeing today. Has the jet stream changed over time? Is that different, too, as a part of what we're seeing from climate change?
What we're seeing in climate change is the position of where the jet stream is, particularly during the wintertime. And so as we're seeing global warming occurring, we're seeing the jet stream moving further northward, which then keeps those winter storms more further northward than running through the middle of the country.
So it leaves with a drier winter for those parts?
Yes, and we're particularly going to see that with an El Nino going on. That warming of the oceans warms the general area, and the jet stream tends to move further north in our wintertime, so we won't get as many snowfalls typically.
I saw this from the USA Today over the weekend. Mind-blowing El Nino stuns scientists was the headline. And one of the quotes here is from Zeke Hausfather, a research scientist at Berkeley Earth, who says it's not only very likely to be the strongest event since reliable records began, it may end up being the strongest by a truly mind-blowing margin. So this is taking place out in the Pacific Ocean somewhere, and it's somehow going to reach all the way to have an impact on weather here, Steve?
Yes, because what's happening in the Pacific is when he talks about a mind-blowing increase in El Nino, you know, it doesn't sound all that much because they're talking about like 2 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about heating up that much water, just even a tenth of a degree, that's a huge amount of energy. And where do we get a lot of our water vapor that feeds storms or is through evaporation off the ocean? And so I think that's one reason why they're talking it a mind blowing. They're really talking about what's going on with the ocean. But then as a result, that impacts where our jet stream's going to be. Because both the oceans and the atmosphere during wintertime are trying to move heat out of the tropics and into the northern regions of the globe.
Sure.
And oceans do that, and the atmosphere does that. And if oceans are warmer, they're going to be moving more energy northward.
Because that heat follows the cold. It's looking for the space that the cold air has. So this could mean, according to this article, droughts, heavy rainfall, heat waves, but also the possibility that it would tamp down some of the Atlantic hurricane season. What does the mind-blowing El Nino off the Pacific, what would it mean for Wisconsin, Steve?
Typically, it means that we're going to have relatively mild winters.
Oh, okay.
And by that, I mean we won't have a lot of snowfall. So if you really like a lot of snow in Wisconsin, which I know many people do.
Right. That's why we're here.
That's why we're here. if you want to go skiing, you may have to go to those places that make their snow. That's typically the impact on Wisconsin, less snowfall in the wintertime because it's a little bit warmer.
There's a lot of snowmobilers that are gritting their teeth at the sound of that. I mean, it's been hard in years of late, but with a mind-blowing El Nino, the likes of which we've never seen, it has to make you wonder. But is that the extent of it? Will we see the end of the effects of El Nino at the end of this winter? Will there be something lingering around that we should watch for?
Typically, the statistical correlation is associated with the amount of snowfall in the Great Lakes region in general.
Daniel emailed us, in the mid-60s, watching weather from Eau Claire, the weatherman was talking about dew points in the 60s. He talked to several old-time weathermen who had never seen in their careers dew points that high. In recent years, Daniel says, we have seen dew points in the 80s. Are temps and humidity threatening to make sections of the earth uninhabitable? Wisconsin uninhabitable?
Can't imagine that unless maybe we go back to the Ice Age.
The glaciers come back, then we'll talk.
But we are seeing, I hadn't heard that observation of, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, dew points, you know, basically in the 60s at night. We are seeing increases in dew points, and part of that's associated with a trend in the warmer temperatures in nighttime. As I was saying this morning, you know, it was 79 degrees at my house and foggy, which means the dew point was also 79 degrees. Which, you know, again, I got to go back and recalibrate my thermometer because I just can't imagine a dew point of 79 degrees. But when I went outside, it was hot.
Yeah, you could feel it, and you immediately
in the morning.
You start expressing that through your sweat glands, and which brings me to my next. Don called, couldn't stay with us. He's in Bayfield, and he just has this to say. I'd like to kiss the person who invented air conditioning. Don in Bayfield feeling pretty emotional about his AC, and we can all understand and appreciate that. But in Bayfield, you'd consider, at least until, you know, recently, and I think about this living summers off Lake Michigan as a kid, you wouldn't think about needing AC in Bayfield or you know, in Sheboygan back in the day.
Boy, yeah, particularly being around the Great Lakes, they are kind of cold. I'm surprised. But yeah, if it's getting that hot, of course, it's going to be a personal choice too, right? I mean, I don't like a very humid house either.
But right. As you said, it's not just how hot, it's that dew point.
It's that dew point.
And it doesn't take much.
Yeah.
That's Listener,
and that's what the air conditioners are doing. They're cooling the air, but they're also drying it out.
Yes. Listener email, due to climate change, where would be a good place to move to avoid the turbulent weather we are seeing in many parts of the U.S.? Where aren't we seeing it, Steve?
I think probably everybody who's living in a particular place in the U.S. has got something to complain about with regard to the weather.
So I could recommend
someplace on the West Coast or the East Coast around water, around an ocean. But inevitably, after you live there for probably 5 years, you'll find a way to complain about the weather. Right?
Well, if you're out on the West Coast, then it's earthquakes. It's not the weather so
That's
much.
True.
It's the ground underneath you that you got to worry about. So if the thunder don't get you, then the lightning probably will. So you get to pick your battles, I would imagine. It's an interesting question because, okay, if you're not going to go to the U.S., maybe you'd go to Canada, but we've seen the results of some of the Canadian weather recently and some of the air quality issues that we've been having in Wisconsin, Steve.
Particularly this year, Canada's been pretty dry, and because of that, once that fire got going in Alberta, boy, and there's a fire going in Oregon now too, I believe, still going. It's dry, and that means there's fuel, and those fires generate a lot of smoke, and then if the winds are wrong, it's gonna bring it down to where we live.
Now, I know you're just, an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, not necessarily a timber expert or a land management guru, but is this, again, one of the ancillary results of global climate change? Is this something we're seeing as a result of changing weather trends, the jet stream, and the lack of precipitation in these forests?
There's a couple of things that I think are going on. One is climate change and weather changes. There has been a study by the U.S. Fire Service, and what they're looking at is what is fire season, right? So they define it by how dry it is, what the winds are, what kind of fuel is out there. And what they're finding is that wildfire season is increasing. So the time in which you could have one is getting longer. The other thing they found, which I found really interesting, is the number of wildfires was decreasing. And so the areas burned are also going up. It implies to me that once they get going, it's pretty hard to stop them. So we're getting a lot of we get these big extreme forest fires like we saw in Alberta this past month.
Interesting. So the science suggests we're getting longer wildfire seasons, although the number of wildfires are going down, the size of these wildfires are going up.
Yeah, the size of the area they burn.
The size of the burn themselves is increasing.
Right. Yep.
Very interesting. And yeah. I've got more questions here about the smoke that we've had, how it's reached us to how it's been so thick in Wisconsin from all the way in Alberta. But I want to take a moment here and remind folks that you're welcome to our conversation. We're talking about weather while we're seeing some severe weather right now, especially in the Appleton, Oshkosh area. Saw it earlier this morning in southeastern Wisconsin. And if you've got questions about what you're seeing where you are welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email. You can send a picture if you like, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Steve Ackerman. He's the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and there is no shortage of things to talk about when it comes to Wisconsin weather. And it feels like that wasn't always the case. When I was a kid, I kind of think it was something you just asked as sort of polite talk. It was small talk. How's the weather? The weather's fine. You'd move along. It wasn't a big deal. But now it's like, how's the weather? Well, we've got a tornado in Appleton. So I hope you are staying safe where you are, and I welcome you to our conversation. It continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News. From the National Weather Service in Green Bay, a tornado warning does remain in effect until 12:45 for southwestern Calumet County. There's a severe thunderstorm capable of producing a tornado located over central Lake Winnebago, just about 6 miles east of Oshkosh and moving south at 35 miles per hour. Perfect to have then with us on the Lee Rayburn Show this hour, Steve Ackerman, one half of the Weather Guys. Jonathan Martin, by the way, is biking through Europe at the moment. It probably is a little hot where he is today. But Steve's the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, answering your weather questions today at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Let's go all the way to Colorado, where Dean's in Evergreen. Hi, Dean.
Hi, and best wishes to you on your inaugural here on the weather show.
Thank you so much, man.
See that we're in good hands, and
thank you.
Good to hear Steve's back. I hope you guys fix the humidity problem you have up there in Wisconsin. We're planning to come up there with our sailboat in a few weeks to sail on Lake Superior for a month or two. this humidity here is, as you know, is the opposite problem. My wife complains that bringing the food from the kitchen over to the dining room has gotten cold. And the reason why is because, yeah, it's losing heat, but it's also evaporating, compounding the problem. Anyway, my observation on the forest, because I worked on a scientific study called Boreas. It was a NASA-funded study doing carbon research and hydrology in the north in the boreal forest. And over these decades, there's been a lot of drying, which, as you mentioned, leads to a lot of available fuel to burn. To me, it seems it's a natural sort of consequence, because as the boreal forest continues to dry with warmth and compounded by these heat domes, I think a record was set recently with this ridge a couple of weeks ago, putting a lot of heat over the north territories and northern states, that this is recipe for major fires. So it doesn't seem like it should be that much of a surprise. And I know growing up, I don't remember this much smoke. We have had a number of fires, big ones around here too, but I just don't remember this much smoke when I was a kid.
Yeah, we have certainly seen it here in Wisconsin, and we welcome you back, Dean, and smooth sailing on Lake Superior when you get here. So there is the opposite humidity, and last time I was outside the Denver area, I could feel it. It felt like a desert out there, even in the fall time. There just wasn't a lot of moisture in the air, and that could be a recipe for forest fires, and that appears to be the case, Steve.
The forests, of course, are up in the mountains in Colorado. That whole eastern half is plains and grasses that actually can burn pretty quickly if they're dried out. And so, we haven't solved the humidity problem here in the summer. We still get humid. But if you're on Lake Superior, you can always take a dip in that really cold water. That'll cool you off. You don't have to perspire to cool down, that's for sure.
Just beware of hypothermia when you do. You've got a few minutes in there. But and Dean mentions the wildfires, and they're not isolated to Alberta. We've seen them in Minnesota and Canada and in years past in Washington State. And it's become common or part of the summer, but what I don't remember in years past is this particular smell, how dense the smoke has been all the way from Canada here in south central Wisconsin, Steve. And it just, maybe it's me, but it smells different to me this year, almost chemically or garbagey.
It's interesting you point that out, because for me, from my perspective, because when we had that smoke all come down here from the fires up in Alberta, you know, when I looked out my window, I could see that visibility was dropping and, you know, maybe a mile and a half or so. But when I went outside, I could immediately smell the smoke.
Oh.
And I don't have a great sense of smell either. but that really told me that, this must be a really high concentration of small particles. And that's why We had the air quality index warning come out from the EPA.
How can this smoke travel all the way from Alberta into south central Wisconsin without dissipating, with being so thick and so many particles in the air that you could feel in your nostrils?
Two reasons. One is the wind is in the right direction, and so it's bringing that smoke down here. And the other is that, you know, you can get an indication of how much is burning up there. So some of that smoke, those bigger smoke particles in particular, are dropping out and settling out of the atmosphere. But the smaller ones are going to stay in the atmosphere longer. And because there's so many of them, because of the amount of material that's being burnt in the forest, that it finds its way all the way down, not only to us, but it actually also made it to the East Coast. I have family living in North Carolina, and they said that they could even see it.
So this was a result of quantity, just how massive these
storms were. How massive the fire was, yeah.
Fascinating.
What they're burning, yeah.
Let's go back to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll go next to Perry in Oconto. Hi, Perry.
Hello. I just want to make an observation. Just in an hour, we got 1.5 inches of rainfall in Oconto, and our rivers right here have gone up by a foot and a half as well.
Wow. Yeah, when I heard the tornado warning go on, I fired up my radar on my iPhone to take a look at it, and holy mackerel, it is really raining heavily down there. But 1.5 inches in a short amount of time is a lot of rain.
It's a burst, and then you think about how it's affecting the waterways and then how that could affect flooding near homes, and all of this really adds up, whether it's smoke, fire, or water.
It's hazardous, yes. Too much of anything is a little hazardous.
That goes back to the question, who was it? It was like, where can I live where I can get away from all this? There's no escape.
Right, there's no escape. Right? Or, you know, maybe you just keep moving. But if you're going to do that, you know, don't do it in a car, because you're just adding more carbon dioxide and you're going to make it warmer. So.
you're not making things any better out
there. You're not making things any better, right?
I appreciate the report from Oconto, and stay safe, Perry. When we had the smoke a couple weeks ago, I had a friend who was living and dying by the air quality index, and it made me wonder, what is this index? How is it calculated? And how close should I adhere to it, Steve?
I would adhere to it really well.
Okay.
And important. It's put out by the EPA. They look at a couple of things in this recent episode. I think the most obvious was the amount of small particles. And the amount of small particles is important, because those are the ones that can get in. We breathe in and they get into our lungs. You know, big particles like what we might have, you know, in an evening campfire, a lot of that's going to get caught in our nose, and we're going to, you know, in the mucus in our nose. And so it won't get into our lungs, but these small particles can get into our lungs. They also look at some of the gases that might be in the air at the time, like ozone or nitrous acids. I don't think that was the case here with these forest fires. I think it was more of the small particles. So when they put a high warning, I mean, it's the typical coloring. I don't remember the exact numbers, but, you know, it's red for bad, or purple for really bad. Green is okay, yellow not so good, red and deep purple are really bad. And so when that smoke was here in Madison, you know, we were highlighted in the red and in sometimes even the purple.
Yeah.
And so I stayed indoors. I mean, you could put masks on and go outside, but I didn't even go outside. I just stayed indoors because I didn't really want to deal with it.
But for some, that's not an option. They've got to get out there. And I saw a lot of folks without masks in our red and purple days. And it's not like you can tell folks what to do, but I feel like it's an unnecessary danger.
Yes, for sure. The one thing that I did notice, which I was very happy about, is they're doing a lot of road work by where we're living. They're ripping it all up, and they're repaving it and putting down sidewalks and everything. On that really bad smoke day, nobody was working. And so I assume, and it makes sense to me, that the company or the state or whatever said, no, this is too dangerous. Nobody should be out there, even with a mask. And I thought that was really a really good thing to do.
Are we out of the woods when it comes to smoke from wildfires this summer, Steve?
I would not predict that.
Okay.
We heard, there is like 24 forest fires up in Oregon now.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it'll make it down here will depend on whether or not the air circulation will bring it down. But I think fire season's not over, and so there'll always be a chance that we'll get some again. Hopefully not as bad as we have been getting.
But it feels like a more common event. I don't remember this so much as a kid. Maybe Mount St. Helens I remember, but I don't remember forest fires having their way with Wisconsin weather when I was a child.
Yeah, yeah. I grew up in a different state, but I think, again, like we were just talking about, the fire season, the duration is getting longer.
Yeah.
And so we might expect that means we're going to have a higher chance of getting smokier now than we did 20 years ago.
Jim emailed us, are we in an irreversible loop of wildfires that cause tremendous amounts of CO2, which causes global warming, which in turn causes higher temperatures and drought in many areas, which causes more fires and results in more carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere?
Boy, yeah, that's a nightmare scenario, right? Because as he's pointing out, you know, when we have a fire, our CO2 is getting into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And part of that is because that's one thing vegetation do. They take CO2 out of the atmosphere, right? And they store it in their wood or their plant material. But I hesitate to look at that as a big problem with regard to global warming.
Okay.
The biggest problem with global warming is what we're doing in terms of humans burning fossil fuels.
Let's go back to your questions for our guest, Steve Ackerman, the emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, at 1-800-642-1234. Bill in Verona, you're next. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you have for us today?
For a long time, I've wondered, a lot of the high temperature records for this time of year came from the mid-30s, Dust Bowl days, 33, 36. And we were probably in a climate that was 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit colder than we have as a baseline now. And yet those high temperature records have endured for 100 years almost. I'm just wondering if climatologists have been able to reconstruct what was going on that made that period really, really hot for that baseline.
Boy, that is a good question. I think the initial answer to your question is yes. I think they really have looked at that and what was going on during those Dust Bowl eras. And it might be associated with a lack of precipitation. So systems moving, the dynamics moving away from where the dust bowls were, so we didn't have that precipitation. But I don't know personally what the answer to that is. I'd have to think about that some more.
I remember reading a book. It's just a stark and kind of – it was a tough read. But to me, it seemed like a lot of it was clear-cutting some of the native prairie grasses and trying to grow and leaving empty fields where there used to be, like you mentioned, CO2-capturing plants wiped out for the sake of the hope of agriculture there.
Yeah, that's true. That was going on back then. And, you know, once you remove that prairie land, that vegetation, and put bare soil down there, that's going to make it hotter for sure.
So it sounds like probably a combination of a number of things, including the weather patterns at the time. But it's a great question, Bill, and I'm glad you asked. Thank you. Let's go to Chris in Fairchild next. Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon. I was wondering if the guest would be able to perhaps speak to how the National Weather Service and NOAA interact with state and local emergency management services to better perhaps predict where situations may arise and the best direction to kind of position themselves, the staffing of these agencies and what their potential needs are now and may need to be in the future. And then secondly, earlier on in this current administration, there seemed to be some withholding of some rather exquisite radar data from local meteorologists to better predict. And I was wondering if that access has been fully restored.
So in the first part of your question, yes, NOAA, National Weather Service, and the emergency broadcasting networks work closely together when severe weather is approaching, whether it's fire, thunderstorms, tornadoes, downbursts. There's a lot of talking going on to make sure that the right messages go out to the public in terms of warnings and watches. With regard to the radars, I know there were budget cuts in the current federal government to NOAA. I'm not sure where it's going in terms of radar access. I know it is going into other important data observations like upper air winds, upper air temperature, which are desperately needed for accurate numerical weather prediction models. I'll have to look into the radar. I'm not aware of that. I've been looking continually at radar data, and I haven't noticed any National Weather Service sites that are down because of funding.
Well, Chris, I appreciate the call and the questions. Let's go next to Gage in Madison. Gage, hi.
Hi. First, just want to mention, Lee, you're doing a great job with the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
For picking up the reins. My question is, I hear a lot of people talking about staying inside when the weather is bad, but I'm not too clear on why the inside air is, you know, better than the outside air. Like, I could tell it smells much cleaner, but I have a 30-year-old window unit AC, so I don't think that's really doing much cleaning.
I have the same. I have an old AC that runs out my window, and that's the best I can get. Does that do me any favors when it comes to air quality alert day, Steve?
Well, as I mentioned, when that really bad smoke days hit our area, I stayed indoors.
Yeah.
I didn't put a mask on, but we have two air purifiers going on. And so that's another way to deal with it. If you do have leaky windows, which certainly many people have, is to get an air purifier in the home. And that'll take out some of the small particles for sure.
Gage, we are in the same boat. But I usually run my air purifier in the winter because my windows are closed and I'm not getting any fresh air. But I would run this in air quality days because I'm not getting any fresh air for the same exact reason. Even the air outside is stale. Yeah.
Yep.
That is a good point. And you've written a little bit, Steve, about how these wildfires can actually create weather. We've talked a lot about how the weather can create the conditions for these wildfires, but how can they create some of the weather that we see?
One is to bring smoke down to an area so they change the air quality. The other is when these fires get really intense, it's like a thunderstorm, and they can influence the weather and the air movements. When I say weather, I think of air movements as well in that area. And so you can get, like in the thunderstorms, you can get downslope winds where you have upward air going in the thunderstorm to feed the thunderstorm, and then you have sinking air to go with it, the downbursts we were talking about earlier. In thick wildfires that are burning a lot of wood, again, there's all that heat's going to go up, which means that some of that air has got to come down. And so you can get local fire fronts, if you will generate downflow in the storm. And then air, when it hits the ground, it just moves horizontally.
Oof. So the heat actually can create its own sort of microclimate.
You get your own circulation in the fire, and it
wow.
sort of feeds itself. As I think it was Chris who was saying, you know, so the fire starts, air goes up, hot air goes up. That means to fill in that low because
yep.
of the at the surface, air moves in, and that just brings more oxygen, because that's the other thing you need to burn a fire is oxygen. And so you're bringing in fresh air at the surface, and you end up with a whole circulation in the large fire.
I feel bad that it's taken extreme weather for me to really see that clearly the picture of weather as a system, as in these interconnected elements that are all working in concert and back and forth together to create an overall balance. But it is in the degrees of extreme that you find some of the more extreme weathers as a result.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to put it, you know, is that these are systems.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a thunderstorm. That the storms they're seeing up in Appleton and Milwaukee now, it's a system of storms all working together to try and cause some kind of balance. Unfortunately, the atmosphere has gotten out of balance, and these storms are trying to move it back into balance, although doing it very violently.
Yeah, it's enlightening, and I got time for one more call here, so let's go to Dot in Manitowoc
sure.
while we can. Hi, Dot.
Hi, good afternoon. What is the weight of a hill? Is it a ball, of course, but I was just wondering, they vary naturally, just the weight of a hill ball.
You know, we always hear it in terms of size. It's a golf ball, it's a baseball, it's a pebble, but we never hear in terms of weight, and yet when it hits, we hear that weight explicitly.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I was thinking the same thing, Lee, that when we talk about a hailstorm, we're talking about the average size of the hailstones themselves. To do it in terms of the weight is probably harder, because you would need to collect a whole bunch of them in order to get a representation of the area.
Sure.
And that's pretty hard to do, I would think.
So, yeah, you'd have to take you'd have to count the average, you'd add them all up, weigh them all, and you'd have to do it while they're still frozen, because as soon as they hit the ground, they're going to start melting off.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the force that they're coming down with is not just the weight of the storm, but also a lot of times they're caught in the downdraft, or they're making the downdraft, and they're falling from a high up in the storm. So that also contributes to the force in which they hit your roof or wherever.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's certainly a great question, Dot, and thank you for asking.
Yeah.
I've got about a minute, but I want to get to the last email. Jeff emailed us. They took an international flight from Europe to the U.S. On the in-flight monitors, they could follow the flight's progress and see the temperature outside the plane, which was 40 to 50 degrees below zero. I think you talked about this upper air temperatures before, Steve. How can that be 40 to 50 degrees below zero when we are having such high temps at ground level?
Yeah, the high temps at the ground level are associated with the exchanges of heat between the atmosphere and the ground, which is getting warmed up by solar energy. That kind of heating we can't get high up in the atmosphere. So the solar energy, most of it passes through the atmosphere rather than heating it up.
So what we're getting on the ground level is from the sun, and that is not something that we find up in...
Right. The sun heating the ground, and then the ground transferring some of that air warmth into the atmosphere above.
You make it sound like the Earth is a solar panel of itself.
In some regards, yeah. That's why we often have, right, the warmest temperatures are near the ground, and then they decrease.
The higher up you go.
The higher up you go.
Yeah.
Until we get the tropopause. And then some of that solar energy, particularly at the high energy, the UV type of wavelengths, are being absorbed by ozone. And that allows the upper stratosphere then to increase and get warmer. But it's still minus 40, minus 50.
Right.
It's not going to get up to 90 degrees. Yeah.
Not up there. Steve Ackerman, thank you so much for showing me the weather in a way that helps me put these pieces together in a way that I can see it and understand it. Very much appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
And- And thank you, Lee. It was a great conversation.
I enjoyed it immensely. Steve Ackerman is the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Thanks to our team, Joel Patnaud, Clara Neipert, Jill Nadeau, Jeff Robbins. And thanks to you for being a part of the show. We'll be back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.